From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Just judging by the political makeup of Utah voters, it could be said the real fight for Orrin Hatch this campaign season came in the spring when he faced a fellow Republican in a primary election. Just a few years before, Senator Bob Bennett had been ousted in the state convention by Tea Party voters, and Hatch was determined not to experience the same fate. So he burnished his conservative credentials, he spent millions courting delegates, and even more in the primary, and it worked. He crushed State Senator Dan Lilienquist. Now the senator is facing Democrat Scott Howell as he goes for his seventh term in the U.S. Senate. Today in the program, we continue our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office. Senator Hatch will be with us today, live from the Hinckley Institute of Politics, after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Utah Senator Orrin Hatch has said if he wins re-election this year, it will be his last term. That would make it his seventh. The senator has been in Congress since 1977. He's the longest-serving Republican in the Senate. And this year he's up against former State Senator Scott Howell, who joined us a few weeks ago to talk about the issues in the race. Today, it's Senator Hatch's turn. We're live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics on the campus of the University of Utah as we continue our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office. Senator Hatch is the ranking Republican in the Finance Committee. He also serves in the Subcommittee for Energy, Natural Resources, and Infrastructure, and for health care as well, among others. Senator Hatch is a former chairman of both the Judiciary and Labor Committees. And Senator Hatch, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
Well, we're happy to be with you, Doug, and happy to be with all our fellow students here at the University of Utah, because I'm learning constantly, too.
Good. I wanted to begin by asking you to go back a bit, if you don't mind,
sure,
to that race in 1976. I'm not sure how much you remember about it, but I'm just trying to get a sense of how are you thinking about why you wanted to run then, and what was the case that you were trying to make to voters?
Well, I was practicing law. I had my own law firm. We were doing great guns. But I was constantly decrying how liberal Senator Moss was. And finally, a bunch of my friends said, well, why don't you run? There were already four in the race, but I didn't think any of the four could beat him. And, of course, I was not well-known. I was well-known in the legal community. I was well-known in my church community. But, I had zero name recognition as far as politics. But I decided at the last minute of the last day, it was literally right at 5 o'clock when I went to, I think it was then called the Secretary of State's office, and I signed up, and I walked out, and there was a bank of television cameras, and my knees buckled. I remember I wasn't used to that. And I decided that I would run and see if we could get a conservative alternative to Senator Moss, and it seemed to all work out.
So that was the case you were making. I mean, it was a different political landscape in Utah at the time, but that was the case that you were making, that it was about liberal versus conservative.
Well, very much that. It was that plus I disagreed with him on a lot of things that he was doing. I agreed with him on some, of course. And he was a fine person. There was no reason to, dislike him or anything other than his political views. And it became a... The problem was getting through the primary, getting up to a primary.
Yeah.
And we were able to do that, and we were able to win the primary. That was when... I think I'm the only one in history that Ronald Reagan pre-primary endorsed.
Wow.
I had started supporting him back in 1976, and he knew it, and he endorsed me. And I think Dick Werthen had a lot to do with that. He didn't know who I was, but he had a nephew who was a bishop in the same building where I was a bishop at the time. Hmm. He said, "Do you know this Orrin Hatch guy?" And he said, "Yeah." He said, "What about him?" He said, "Well, he's a great bishop. He's really, a great attorney." And so Dick did some survey work, and he found out that, that I had very low name identification, but that I was, and he started checking with people and found out that I was well-known in the legal community for being a good lawyer. And I'm sure he gave the president, then candidate,
Ronald Reagan.
Yeah, well, then candidate Ronald Reagan, the advice that, you know, you'll have a friend for life. And Ronald Reagan did. He would have had me anyway. He didn't lose anything if he hadn't supported me. I was a very strong supporter of Ronald Reagan at the time.
Yeah. Now, you know this.
I was going to say Romney there, and I thought, well, that's not right.
Yeah.
I got Romney on my mind so much right now.
Yeah, different guy, yeah.
Yeah.
For the past several years, as you know, your opponents have been mentioning the slogan that you used in that first race. You were running against Senator Moss, and you were telling voters the senator had lost touch with his constituents.
Well, he had
been there so long. And this is the slogan. Of course, you've heard it before. Mm-hmm. What do you call a senator who served in office for 18 years? You call him home. Now, it seems like a fair question. If Moss had been there too long, how do you argue that you haven't been there too long?
Well, he didn't represent the state, in my opinion. He did in some ways, but he didn't represent the state.
Wasn't that the argument we were making? That it wasn't... It seems like you were making an argument that you've been there too long. You've lost...
No, I had said before that... I said on many occasions that 18 years was enough if you're not... And they always leave the last part off. If you're not acting in the best interests of the state. If you're not really representing the state. I'd said that over and over, but they only talk about the front part. And 18 years is enough to have a liberal representing a conservative state like Utah. And so that's what happened, and I think I was able to get that across.
Did you intend when you first went to the Senate, Senator Hatch, that you would stay as long as you have?
No, I didn't intend to, but I actually have the mindset that I'd stay as long as I felt I was really doing a great job and really doing a good job for my constituents and in our state and our country. And, you know, I think most people would acknowledge that I've done a very, very good job. I've been very active, and I've chaired a number of committees, and now I'm in a position where I'm the Republican leader on the Finance Committee. And if the Republicans take control, I'll become the chairman of the Finance Committee, and that's no small thing. That's the most powerful committee in the whole Congress. Ways and Means is certainly there with it, because that's where all money bills have to originate, but the Finance Committee in the Senate is where 60% of all the spending is. That's where this bloated tax code is. That's where, you know, the entitlement programs are, Social Security, Medicaid, Medicare, international trade, bonding, you name it, it's in that committee. And if we're going to get this country under control, it's going to take leadership on that committee.
I did want to ask you about that because there was an article that came out late last month in Politico that suggested that you're not a shoo-in for the chair of the Finance Committee.
Well,
that Charles Grassley may be, that he's probably leaning towards, if the Republicans can take the Senate, he would be leaning towards judiciary, but he's considering, because of all the things that will be happening in finance. Are you worried about your good friend,
not at all,
Chuck Grassley?
I know my friend Chuck Grassley, and frankly, I'm going to be chairman of that committee.
Has he made a commitment to you, or you just think it'll work that
he's
way?
He's basically indicated that, yeah. And it's still, you have to be elected to be chairman.
Yeah.
A lot of people want me there as chairman.
You're counting votes, are you?
No, but I can tell you this, I know the votes.
Yeah, right. I wanted to go back to this length of being in office. What do you think the country's founders had in mind in terms of the number of years that a person would serve in public office? Because you often hear...
Well, some didn't, you know, they didn't know.
I mean, you often hear that people say the founders had no intention that someone would stay 20, 30, 40. Some of your colleagues...
They probably did, a number of them. And the number of them, I think, you know, they would have kept George Washington there for life if they could have. So, you know, it all depends on who the person is and what they can do for the country. I think you can find arguments every which way.
And of course, there's no general consensus, you don't think, among...
Well, I don't think so. I don't think anybody really thought of it. I didn't think of it either, that I would be there longer than any other person who's ever served from Utah.
Yeah.
But, you know, I've been chairman of the Labor and Human Resources Committee, now the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions. I've been chairman of the very powerful, and that's a powerful authorizing committee, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, where I've handled some very, very tough issues all of those years, and then, of course, the rise to the level of being ranking member on the Finance Committee with the potential of being chairman, that takes years. It takes years to get on the Finance Committee, let alone become chairman of it.
So is the message then to those who are running for office that in order for you to get power, to wield, maybe that's a crass way of putting it, in order for you to have influence on some of these committees, you've got to stick around?
Well, I had influence right away because... At that time, the Democrats controlled the Senate 62 Democrats to 38 Republicans. The biggest issue was called labor law reform. It was a bill that would have turned the country over to the unions. And everybody who was anybody in the business community came to me in my little tiny office in the Dirksen building and said, "We know we can't win, but we want you to lead this fight." And the only reason they came to me, I was 98th in seniority, I was all that was left.
Right.
Nobody else was willing to take it on. It was going to go through the House without any problem. And the Senate looked like it was just a slam dunk in the Senate. And I said, "Yeah, I'll take it on. I'll take it on for if you'll do two things." And they said, "What are those?" I said, "Well, number one, if I ask you to do something, you do it, no matter what the cost." I said, "I'll try not to ask you to do things that are exorbitant, but if I ask you to do it, you've got to do it." Well, they all, these are leaders of the National Chamber of Commerce, National Federation of Independent Business, the National Association of Manufacturers, the hoteliers, the drug companies, everybody.
Yeah.
They were very, very concerned about this. So number one, they coughed and sputtered, but finally said, "Okay, what's number two?" I said, "Number two is nobody breaks ranks." They all started huffing, puffing, they all let out a big wheeze about it, because they'd never been able to keep the business community together, because the union companies would be threatened by the unions, and they would always break ranks. But they had no choice. Finally, they said, "Okay." Right in the middle of it, after they were going to get, Bob Byrd was the majority leader. He was going to give us two cloture votes. When I say us, I asked Dick Lugar of Indiana to help me on this, and he, to his credit, decided to do so. His job was to get people to come to the floor so I didn't have to do all the talking. And we made a good team. Well, what happened was is that they were going to give us two cloture votes because they didn't want to crush two freshman senators and have it really look bad.
Yeah.
But on the third vote, we won again. And I think it was right after that I was informed that Bethlehem Steel was going to break ranks. Bethlehem Steel was a steel company in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, that had always had troubles. And so I called a meeting at 10 a.m. I went down to that meeting, and everybody who was anybody was there in the business community, and other communities as well that hated that bill, which was a one-size gift to the trade unions that would have really upset the balance of power that exists in the country. There was no reason for it. It was just an awful bill, but they were going to get it. They won the election. They were going to win. And so I stood up in front of them. I said, "Look, I'm going to be here a long time." I said, "And I've heard an ugly rumor. The one of you is going to break your word to me, because you all promised that we would not have anybody break ranks." And then I said, "I'm going to be here a long time. I pity the company that does that, because I will spend the rest of my time in the Senate killing that company." And then I just walked out. It was like a Polish Catholic church. They were so tightly together. They were all standing, and they pulled apart so I could walk out through the middle. I walked right out on them, and they just converged on Bethlehem Steel and were able to keep them there. They were so proud that we had fought this so hard. When we went to six historic cloture votes, the most cloture votes on a substantive issue in the history of the Senate, and frankly, it was a miracle, but we won.
Hmm.
And that was, so from the beginning, I've been right in the middle of almost everything. And
of course,
then Reagan came along in 1980, and when he got elected, I became one of the youngest committee chairmen in history as chairman of the Labor and Human Resources Committee, which had the widest, broadest, agenda of any committee in the Congress.
You know, it's interesting when you talk about, though, the way you were able to negotiate with members of the other side.
Yeah.
Your friend and colleague, former Pennsylvania Senator Arlen Specter, died over the weekend.
That's a real sad thing to me, because Arlen has always been a close friend.
He was different.
Yeah, I was his best friend. I'll put it that way. And he there's no question. We loved each other as human beings. I didn't agree with him on a lot of things, but Arlen came from Philadelphia and Pennsylvania, a more liberal state. He naturally was more liberal anyway, but he was never as liberal as most of the Democrats. But Arlen was always kind of the odd man out in a lot of ways. But we developed a great friendship. He was a very brilliant guy, very smart. I thought, he had fought his way through life like many Jewish people have, who have seen lots of prejudice against them. And so Arlen was kind of a loner, but we were close.
But he's an interesting figure because he was able to sort of go to either side from time to time. Senator right. Kennedy was a good friend of yours, of course, and you you worked with Senator Kennedy.
Well, let me say one more thing about Arlen.
Sure.
I'm going to miss Arlen.
Yeah.
Arlen switched to the Democrats in the end. He started as a Democrat and then became a Republican, and then in the end switched to the Democrats. I felt really badly about that, but it didn't dent our friendship. And frankly, running this time, Arlen came to one of my fundraisers and donated, which was very meaningful to me, because some of my colleagues did not treat him very fairly or very well, on both sides, to be honest with
yeah.
you. But I'm going to miss him.
Yeah.
And I just hope Joan and the family can be comforted at this time.
That raises the question, though, that I wanted to get at, which is the Senate now a less congenial place than it has been?
Well, it has been under this president, because this president has not worked with the Senate and the House. And there's a natural gravitation. The Democrats have gone very far left. The Republicans have gone to the right. And there aren't a lot of people in the middle.
Why do you think
we've always
is?
Had 3 to 6 more liberal Republicans who would go with the Democrats on spending issues, but would be with us on some of the other issues. And I think it's just become polarized to a degree that we've got to change.
But why? Why is that? Why do you think? You just said the president. Surely you're not blaming President Obama solely for that. There's
oh,
got to
no,
be other
of course
factors.
Not. But it's been this way for a while. I think President Obama helped bring more liberal Democrats into the United States Congress. There's no question about that. He was a dynamic, spokesperson and certainly a campaigner. And a very interesting man. And of course, there were, and they've just gone continuously left. I can tell you this, when Bob Byrd was the majority leader, he was tough as nails.
Yeah.
But he always put the Senate first. He would not take any guff from any president. Like the president doing these executive orders and ignoring the rules that we'd had in the Senate, and basically bypassing the Congress in the ways that the president has. Bob Byrd would not have put up with that.
But were you opposed when there were executive orders coming from the Bush administration? Because some came from the Bush administration as well.
Bush administration was pretty conservative in many ways, although he tried to get along. You know, he didn't veto a bill until, his seventh year. And which I think is a major criticism of the Bush administration. There were a lot of bills he should have vetoed. But frankly, the first 4 years, the Republicans controlled both houses. But what a lot of people don't seem to understand is that in 2007 and 8, the Democrats took control of both houses of Congress. And that's when the spending started to go way higher than before. Now, the wars had cost us some spending, but we were spending like 40% of the GDP. All of a sudden, it shot up to 60%. And today, it's in the 70s. And ever since the Democrats took control of both houses, and then, of course, Obama came in, and that just added even more. Saw that in the Obamacare debate, that he was willing to make that a totally partisan debate, and it passed in a totally partisan way. And that's one-sixth of the American economy. And any time you have one-sixth of the American economy affected by a piece of legislation up on Capitol Hill, and it's done solely on a partisan basis, you've got a good chance that it's a really lousy bill.
But Senator,
and we're now finding that's what it is.
But you've heard the response to that, which is some of the basic framework of that bill came from Republicans. That these were Republican ideas, the Heritage Foundation for one, Governor Romney for another. These were Republican concepts.
No, that's not a fair characterization.
But isn't it fair to say some good part of it?
Some of the good parts of the bill we were talking about too.
Yeah.
For instance, they didn't do anything about medical liability reform, which is driving costs way beyond where they should be. Nobody understands that as much as I do. From a standpoint that I used to be a medical liability defense lawyer.
No, I understand that, but I guess what I'm saying is what you were suggesting was that this was an entirely partisan affair. Democrats will say that some of the basic concepts of that Affordable Care Act came from Republicans.
Well, that's what they're going to say, trying to make it up to us. But the fact is, let me take you back.
Okay.
I was invited down to the White House 3 days after the inauguration by Rahm Emanuel. He and Larry Summers met with me, then some cabinet people came in, then Joe Biden came in, an old friend. We've been opposite each other for 34 years. I understood Biden very well last week. And all I can say is this, then the president came in. We had an interesting 45-minute discussion, and finally President Obama said, Orrin, I'd like you and Joe to come back to the Oval Office with me. I said, great. So I got up to leave. And as I was walking out the door, this is 3 days after the inauguration, Rahm Emanuel grabbed my arm and pulled me back. He said, can we do health care? I said, sure. He said, how? I said, I'll tell you how. Ted Kennedy was up on the Cape. Yeah. He was not, you know, he was not as bad off as he later got. Right. I said, I'll tell you what. You call Teddy, and you tell him to tell his staff to do what Orrin asked him to do. Now, that sounds arrogant, but Teddy knew exactly what that meant. That meant that I would bring both sides together, take the best issues from both sides, and do a bill that would have overwhelming support from both sides. Kennedy, as sick as he was, came down. We met in a room right off the floor that Harry Reid gave him. It was S-219. And we sat down, my old friend Ted Kennedy and myself, and staffers. He had his two dogs there, those Portuguese dogs.
Yeah.
It was really something. It was something. And we sat down, and we chatted. And he basically said to his staff, work it out with Orrin. When we finally got into the HELP Committee, Health, Education, Labor, and Pension, that I used to chair, and Kennedy was my ranking member.
Yeah.
They brought up this colossally bad bill. Yeah, it had some good things in it that the Republicans could identify with, but overall it was just awful, leading really to a very socialized takeover of healthcare in America. And we brought up amendments. None of them had a chance. They voted everything down. I went up to Teddy's top staffer, and I said, Teddy would never have done this. Here are his exact words. I don't care what Senator Kennedy wants. This is what I want. Those are his exact words. And it was like we were insignificant, and all the good ideas we had, they weren't going to take. Then we went through I was on that committee. Then the bill, we did a bill through the Finance Committee. They wouldn't take any amendments. And finally, most Republicans voted against it except for one, Olympia Snowe, and she believed it should go out of committee, which is a legitimate belief. But it was just a totally partisan bill. Now, are there some things that you can point to in Obamacare that you could say both sides could agree on? Yeah. Not many, but there are some. And we could have made it so that there would be many that both sides could go to. It'd be much more economically secure and worthwhile. And it would have been something that I think most people would have been proud of. And look, it was no easy thing for me because I'm coming up for election, and the far right, the fact that I could bring Kennedy all the way across to the center right on everything, he'd get all the credit, I'd get all the blame. But the far right resented it, that I would do anything with him. Well, you got to go back in time. Go to the Hatch-Waxman bill. Henry Waxman is the most liberal guy in the House. And I might add one of the most accomplished. He's a very smart guy.
Yeah.
We did the Hatch-Waxman Act that created the modern generic drug industry. It's done right in my office. And it's been considered one of the great health care bills. Or take...
Well, let me stop you for a moment because this sort of gets
to... No, but I'm trying to let you know that we can work together.
Okay, but here's the question that I think comes from that. It's interesting you say we can work together, and you talk about the sort of the far right of the party.
And you've had a number of people willing to work together,
right.
That's for sure.
Well, you've had a number of Republican colleagues experience challenges from...
Right.
You have.
Right.
Richard Lugar, as you know, good friend of yours.
Well, Bob Bennett.
And Bob Bennett. And I guess my question is there a role for and what is the role for moderate Republicans or Republicans like yourself who want to compromise and work with the other side? Is there a role for them in the modern Republican?
Well, sure there is. And we've got to get to where we can work together.
But what was the lesson of Senator Bennett and Richard Lugar? I mean, what did you take from that?
Well, I'm not going to talk about what happened to them other than I thought it was tragic.
What do you mean by that? Tragic.
Well, Bob Bennett was a good senator.
Yeah.
No question about it. He was a good partner of mine. But I have to say that the two who beat him at the state convention were also good people. And Mike Lee came in second at the convention but won the primary. And,
right.
And he's got the potential of being a very good senator. In the case of Dick Lugar, I was really upset about it because Lugar, you know, was a fellow who help me on labor law reform. We're very dear friends. But when I met his opponent, I thought, you know, after he lost, I thought, man, this guy is not a bad man. He's a very nice man. And he'll be a solid conservative.
But less flexible than Richard Lugar, some would say.
I don't know about that.
Really?
I think some of them ran with the far right behind them and became more conservative as they ran. But deep down, some of them know that you have to be open to good ideas from the other side as well as your own. I mean, some people don't even think they can work with their own, you know.
Yeah.
Now, I think what's happened is not necessarily bad in the sense of having a lot of really strong conservatives in the United States Senate. I think that's great between you and me, and most of them have turned out to be very good. Take Rand Paul. I like his father, Ron, but I never quite agreed with Ron. In Rand's case, he's doing an excellent job there.
Yeah, but you're not worried that the party is tacking right, too far right?
I'm worried that if we are not open to working with the other side, but let me tell you, the other side certainly wasn't open to working with us. They've gone way left. You have very few moderates. In fact, I can only name one moderate on the Democrat side right now, and that's Ben Nelson of Nebraska. And he's leaving at the end of this year. Ben's from Nebraska. But there are others who are moderate when their vote isn't needed by the Democrats,
so
or
on
specific state issues.
Yeah.
They can be moderate, but
yeah.
No, they're uniform when it comes to spending.
We need to take a break, but let me get you to respond to this question.
Sure.
Are the state's party conventions, particularly in Utah, of course, disproportionately dominated by the extreme faction of the party, the far right?
Well, I've always done well at state party conventions, and I think by any measure I did well at this last one.
Very well, but you had to spend millions of dollars to do it.
Well, not before the convention, but I have to say, well, we did over a six-year period. I gave a lot of money to colleagues and everybody else.
But that's what happened to Bob Bennett. It can be said that the far right ousted Bob Bennett.
Well, one of the problems was not so much the far right as people were just upset. They were mad at everything.
So it wasn't an ideological thing, you don't think?
Well, it partly was that, but they were mad at everybody. They were mad at everything, and they just said, sweep them all out, and that was the attitude that kind of prevailed. That same attitude prevailed in part in mine, but I caught the message before I think Bob did. I started working with people to let them know, that it wasn't the right thing to do. And I have to say, 2 months before the convention, they were predicting I would lose.
But you had to go. You had to burnish your credentials with the conservatives. You got a ranking from the American Conservative Union. You had somewhere in the 80s, but we moved to get 100%. Did you go further right than you? Did that make you uncomfortable in any of those positions?
Well, I vote what I think is right, but I've got to say that I've averaged 89-point-something%. American Conservative Union voting record for 36 years. It's pretty hard to say that I'm not a conservative. Some of the people knew I was conservative, but they just wanted to throw everybody out. And I don't blame them for that either. I mean, I had to work with them. I had to let them know that, hey, I'm not just the average person. And gradually, I won an awful lot of them over. We would have won the convention had there not been about 30 people in the men's room and women's room. I mean, it was just one of those things. And in a way, it was good. It cost me a lot of money, but we were able to I think, bring our party back to a more reasonable position. And I think people, even some of the very far-right people, started to realize, hey, you can't go so far as you become insignificant and you really don't get things done. And I think it was healthy for me. It was healthy for our party. I think it was healthy for the state. You look at the Democrat side, hey, come on. they're not exactly what you call moderates all the time. But be that as it may, Utah Democrats, I think, want to be more moderate because they know they don't have a chance of getting elected in the state without at least acting like they're moderate. But deep down, when they get back there, they'll vote right with the rest of the Democrats. That's the problem.
Senator Orrin Hatch is with us. He's seeking his 7th term as one of Utah's senators. We need to take a break. We're late for that. We're live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics at the University of Utah, and we'll be back in a moment. This is Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch is joining us live in the caucus room at the Hinckley Institute of Politics. We're on the campus of the University of Utah, and we are continuing our series of conversations with some of the candidates running for office this year. Senator Hatch is up against former state Senator Scott Howell in November's election. He's running for his seventh term. Let me I'll get to some questions here in a moment, but I did want to ask you about... You were talking about spending. You voted for TARP, the TARP program. You voted for the bailout. Do you regret those?
I didn't vote for the bailout. I voted for TARP.
TARP, that's what I meant. Sorry.
And I think we had to. It was early October. We were about to go out. We would have had 6 months without anything being done. We'd been in a depression, or at least a very severe recession. And I didn't want to vote for it because I thought it was just another spending bill. But the fact of the matter is that it was the timing of the thing that made it so. If you didn't vote for it, you were just saying to the country, hope you can get by.
So you don't regret the vote? I mean, if it were to come to
you
again...
I regret it, and I'll tell you why. Because they represented it as a bill that would straighten out the banks. And they misrepresented the bill to us. If I had known what they were going to use the money for, to take care of the banks rather than the real problems that existed, I would have voted against it no matter what. But I have to say that they may have been right in doing that, but I didn't agree with bailing out the big banks. And now we've got a bill that basically protects the big banks from being too big to fail. I don't think we should do that.
But pick winners and losers, the government.
Pick winners or losers, yeah. And the government has done that. And you just take a look at the, GM. I mean, my gosh, they basically pushed the bondholders, who were the preferred creditors, out of the way. And they got like 15% of what they should have gotten out of it. They took care of all the union people, but take one of the big parts suppliers. Their employees, their pension programs were raided. I mean, it was really pathetic.
So you wouldn't have bailed out the
Well, what Romney said is, let them go into Chapter 11, and we'll work it all out, but we'll work it out on a basis that makes sense. That's what Chapter 11 is for, rather than have the federal government and the President of the United States dictate how the money should be spent.
But the President has said there wasn't private money available at the time. The government had to step in, or jobs would have been lost.
Well, but the government could have stepped in. It would have been easier to step in under a Chapter 11 filing.
So the government would have...
Sure.
Played a role.
Well, not necessarily. Not necessarily. If they'd gone into Chapter 11, they may have been able to raise the money. Yeah. But if they couldn't, the government still had the option of stepping in. But you wouldn't have to act like preferred creditors were worthless. You didn't have to ruin the pension programs of a lot of non-union people who lost out terrifically because of what this administration did. And let's face it, they turned a lot of it over to the unions. And I'm not against having the unions be treated fairly, of course not. But in this way, they were treated more than fairly compared to other people. And that's what's wrong with having, the government, and partisan government at that, resolve these problems. Romney was right on it.
Let's take some questions from the audience here. Yes.
My name is Alex Homicetti, and I'm a student here at the U. I just want to know what exactly it means to be the chair of the Finance Committee, if that was going to be you, and how will that affect Utah?
Well, being chair of the Finance Committee is a big thing. Being ranking on the committee is a big thing. Nothing happens on that committee without me. I'll just give you one illustration. The president didn't want the free trade agreements done for Korea, Colombia, and Panama, especially Colombia. Why, I'll never know, because the two presidents of Colombia have really saved the unions, have stopped the murdering, pushed the rebels back, and really got the country back on its feet, and Colombia is our best friend in Latin America. And, the fact of the matter is he fought that, but I fought it through, and so did every other Republican. And Max Baucus deserves credit. He was the chairman of the committee, and he knew that his farmers were not doing well because they couldn't sell their products overseas. So it's very, very important what we do in that committee. We not only passed through, but we had to go for months longer than it would have taken. In fact, it was sitting there for 3 years or longer. We had to go for months longer, but I kept driving it and driving it and driving it until we got
Korean. Korea is one of our best friends in the Orient, and over in Asia, one of the absolute best friends. Colombia, our best friend in Latin America, and then Panama is the financial capital of Central America. I mean, my gosh, it's important that we have good relations with these countries. And so I just kept pushing until finally they just had to do it. And today we're going to have, and it meant about $14 billion of balance of trade to our country. Now, other nations all over the world are doing free trade agreements. We're not, because this administration, I don't think, really believes in them. And we should be doing that, too, because we can sell our products everywhere if we have open free trade agreements and we don't have trade barriers stopping us from doing so. I could go on and on, but I think that's one illustration.
Okay, that's good. Thank you very much.
Doug was having a coronary over here. You know?
No, I'm not. You've got a lot to say. That's terrific. I'll try to move us forward. Yes, another question here from the audience.
Right, yes, here. My name is Heather Hughes. I am a prospective student here, and I live in Grantsville. And my question to you is, what exactly have you done for Utah? What is it that is tangible? You've been in the Senate for a long time, and I'm just wondering what you have done for this state.
Well, virtually everything. I have the best constituent service office in the Congress. We work with every problem. We don't care if you're Democrat, Republican, Independent, or whatever. And there are some whatevers, too. But we help everybody. And our officers are given strict instructions. There's no politics to be played. We want you to help every Utah constituent that needs help. But you can go all the way down the line from Hill Air Force Base, which I've been involved with every year since I've been in the United States Senate. Every year we've had lots of problems at Hill that have to be resolved. Naturally, it's a $5 billion a year facility. I mean, that's how much money that brings in a year. There are 22,000 to 24,000 very high-skilled workers up there. And it's no secret that during the Clinton years, they tried to move all the facilities at Hill, or at least a good percentage of them, to California first. We stopped that. Now, Jake Garn and I did a lot of that. Then Jake Garn, Jim Hansen, and myself did an awful lot to solve these things. And myself and Jim Hansen now... our congressman in the north, Rob Bishop, we work very, very hard to make sure that Hill is not mistreated. And Hill is the best air logistics command in the Air Force. Plus, we have the Utah Test and Training Range, which is terrific. I could go on that, but let me just give some others. Virtually every problem that comes to Utah, I try to solve. Everything from energy to let's say, dietary supplements. It was the Hatch-Harkin Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act that helped to create the huge dietary supplement industry in Utah. It's about $7 billion now. That they told me that's what it is. The fact of the matter is we were about $500 million at the time we passed the DSHEA, or the Dietary Supplement Health and Education Act. You know, we've worked on every lands problem that has happened. We work with individual municipalities and counties. We do everything we can to help everybody in Utah any way we can. We have constant constituents coming to visit us there, here, all over the state. And, of course, we've traveled all over the state trying to help on these matters. We also have tried to help when it comes to I'm sorry, I'm going on too long, but let me just mention one other. We've tried to help with regard to energy. Utah's a land filled with energy. And if we could get the permits from this administration to do the things that we know we can do in energy, we would reap billions of dollars that would go to our school systems. And we wouldn't have nearly the problems we have today. But it's so difficult with this administration to get anything through. We know we have lots of resources. We know that we can develop them. We know we can do it in environmentally sound ways. But just a constant roadblock in this administration, not just our state, but almost every Intermountain state. That's why I'm the chairman of the land subcommittee of the Western States Caucus. And, you know, I could just go on and on, take the downwinders.
Wait, but don't.
You know,
let's get to a few more. Let me ask you a question.
But if you want to take the downwinders, I mean, they were very badly treated. It took me 12 years to get the downwinders bill through. I mean, that was billions of dollars.
Yeah. Sorry to cut you.
Well, maybe not billions. It was about a billion and a little bit more than a billion now.
Email from Christopher, who writes, Christopher wants to know if you believe, Senator, and you've been a big supporter of this, will Congress ever be able to get a balanced budget amendment passed?
Well, you know, I think we can. Let's face it, 49 states have balanced budget amendments, constitutional amendments in their constitutions. Now, I've been the prime mover on that for over 30 years. And I have to say that twice, all the times that I've brought it to the floor, twice we came within one vote. The last time we came within one vote was 1997. And as I walked to the floor to make the final arguments on the balanced budget amendment, I had 67 votes, the exact two-thirds number to be able to pass the balanced budget amendment. As I got to the floor, I was informed one of our Republicans had flipped on us, and we lost by one vote. That's happened twice to me. Now, whether we win or not, it's still important to fight that battle. But we can win, but we're going to have more conservatives and more people who really want to get spending under control, get regulations under control, get the federal government under control. And that's building. I think the Obama administration's helping us that way because people are sick and tired of what's going on.
Another question from the audience. Yes.
Yes, Senator.
Yes, sir.
Joe Andrade on the faculty here.
Yes,
you
sir.
Actually have three opponents in this race.
Right.
What is your view of the role of third-party and independent-party candidates in national politics?
And maybe you should mention that you're one of them. You're running, yes.
But I'm not running against the Senate.
No, you shouldn't, but disclose who you are. And
District 2, Congress.
Sure.
And there's a KCPW forum tonight at the library addressing this very issue. But I'd like your views, Senator.
Well, Joe, anybody can run for these offices. And if they represent a party and they meet the requisites, they have a right. I'll be honest with you, during the pre-convention, I felt that everybody should have been invited to the debates, not just two guys who were former state legislators who were opposed to me. The rest were opposed to me, too. And I admit some of them were in it for various reasons that didn't make a lot of sense, but they paid the price. They walked the walk. They should have been treated fairly. I have no problem with that. On the other hand, if we really want to get things under control, the two major parties are the parties that that people are going to basically vote for. Third-party groups can gum up the works. There's no question about it. And every once in a while, one of them will win. But that hasn't been the case in Utah, I don't think.
Here's an email from Chris who has a question about Affordable Care Act. Forgive me.
Sure.
He says, one of the basic building blocks of the legislation is the individual mandate. This punitive measure that forces an individual to purchase health care or pay a tax is expected to directly affect more than 5 million taxpayers this year alone. Chris wants to know, what is your stance on the individual mandate? Would you work to uphold it or repeal it?
I was the first to call the individual mandate unconstitutional. I was surprised when my friend Justice Roberts went the other way and won on that particular issue. Because I really do not believe that the government can mandate that you have to pay for something along those lines. And everybody called it a penalty. And I don't believe they could do it on a penalty. I do believe they could do it as a tax. And the Chief Justice decided it was a tax. But I was against it. Now, I have to say, we did file a heritage bill back in the early 90s against it was filed to offset the Hillary Care bill, and I didn't pay an awful lot of attention to it then because we had all kinds of good things in that health care bill, including medical liability reform and ways of keeping costs under control. But the more I got into it, the more I determined that it was unconstitutional, and of course I led the fight against it. But I also was one of the few who raised the issue of the Medicare expansion. The state averaged about 22% of their budget for Medicaid and the Medicaid expansion. They averaged about 22% across the states for Medicaid expansion. And how does this president solve that problem? And most states are having a real rough time doing it. Well, he solves the problem by putting 22 million more people onto Medicaid. That's hardly solving the problem. Now, he does say we'll have the federal government pay 100% for 3 years. And then we'll have the federal government pay 90% for the remainder. With what? What are they going to pay? With money from China? That's where it's coming from. I mean, with what? I mean, it's a joke. And frankly, it's bankrupting the states, and it's a very, very big problem. And the states don't like it because they know that they're going to wind up with the full cost of the thing because the government cannot afford to do it. And this is the type of thing, that's just one of the things that's terribly wrong about Obamacare. But I was one of the people, one of the few who raised the issue and said, you know, if you didn't take the 22 million people or didn't take your share of them as your state, then you lost your Medicaid monies. Well, it was a very interesting part of the decision because Roberts, on a 7-2 decision, decided that you don't have to take the money and you don't lose your Medicaid that you have and you don't have to take the other and you're not going to be penalized for not taking it. You know, these are big issues, and you could go on Obamacare. Obamacare was supposed to save...
Hold on. You've made a very good point.
And I'd like to make more, I tell you.
I know you do. Let's take another question here in the back. Yes, go ahead.
Hi, my name is Morgan Lyon-Cotty. I work with Utah Foundation. Oh. Earlier in the interview, you were talking about your experience in the last Republican convention. And now, having been through that nomination process 7 times, I'm curious to know your thoughts about Utah's caucus convention system and what you think about efforts to reform that system or even move to a direct primary.
Well, to be honest with you, I'm going to live with whatever the people in this state determine. But there are many people who feel that
it's... But surely you have a preference, Senator, don't you?
Well, I actually think a primary system probably would be a more accurate system. That's what most other states do. Other states look at us and say, my gosh, why do you do that? But on the other hand, I've always been able to live with whatever our citizens want. And if that's what they want, I'm for it. But, yeah, I think most people would say a real primary system would probably work better. But, you know, to some, that they would never want to lose that system. And I can live with whatever our folks in Utah decide they want to have and have.
In a fundraising letter earlier this, a couple of months ago it was now, State Senator Scott Howell mentioned that Orrin Hatch could die before his term was through. Which has gotten a lot of attention, of course. And I'm wondering, he's asking you to, you know, release health records, those kinds of things. How are you responding to all of that?
Well, that's a desperate remark from a desperate campaign. And frankly, it doesn't deserve an answer. Nobody works harder than I do. Nobody. I get up 4:45 every day back there. I usually don't get home to 8 or 9. If I didn't have Elaine, and no other woman would put up with me. I work so hard, but I've always been that way. When I practiced law and when I was a bishop practicing law, I went those type of hours. And frankly, I think it's an insult to everybody who's a senior citizen.
I won't ask you to do push-ups.
Because there are a lot of people in this state. There are a lot of people in this state who are very, very active, who are very good at what they do, who are real contributors to our state. So, like I say, it's a desperate statement by a desperate campaign.
You've been on the short list for the Supreme Court a number of times with a number of presidents. Are you disappointed that didn't work out?
Not at all.
Something you'd wanted? Or?
Not at all. Reagan basically told me, look, we need you so badly up there to get these people through. And if you watch the confirmation hearings, you would see that I played a very significant role in those hearings.
Well, that's clear, but are you disappointed? It is something that you
wanted. No, because I didn't run for the Senate to become a Supreme Court justice. And frankly, that is a cloister. Once you get there, you really don't have much to do with a lot of other people. Now, I've known every Supreme Court justice since I've been there. They've all been friends, even those who are liberal. And I have to say that I really admire what they do. And I think it would have been fun to do that, except that isn't what I wanted to do. And I have to say, when it came...
Wait. So if a president would have asked you...
Well, if he'd ask you, you'd have to consider that,
yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
But the fact is, I'm happy where I am. And I'm very happy in making sure we get really good people on the court, to the extent that I can.
I wanted to get your take on the way Mormonism has played out in this presidential race. I mean, you ran for president before. I'm not sure if you were subjected to the same kind of scrutiny that Mitt Romney has been.
Well, I didn't have the same type of support either. It was a lot of fun for me.
What do you make of that? What do you make of the way sort of Mormonism has played out as being a member of the faith? Do you think it's been good?
It's despicable, because the fact of the matter is we should never make religion a major political attack. I don't care what religion you are. I believe the First Amendment is pretty explicit on that. But I'll make a prediction. I think the Obama team are going to get clutched in the last few weeks of this campaign, and they're going to trash the trash Mitt Romney's religion.
They're going to go. You're saying
they're already doing it. Well, there are some. There is some push pulling going on in some of the eastern states. Two Catholics saying you can't vote for Mitt Romney because he's not a Christian, when the name of the church is the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Wait, let me get this straight. Are you making a direct accusation that the Obama administration or the Obama campaign itself is directing that kind of push?
No, but people who support the Obama campaign, I've been told, are doing that. That was a Drudge Report, really. It's going to happen, and I'll tell you why. There are approximately 100 million evangelicals in this country. There are about 30% of them. Now, that's men, women, and children. About 30% of them have been very... they don't like the Mormon church, and they would not want to vote for a Mormon for president. But they don't want to vote for Barack Obama. And I believe they'll trash the LDS church, and I think there's some of that going on anyway, to try and stop them from voting for either Obama or Romney. And that could be a serious problem. Now, I know a lot of evangelical leaders. I'm very close to a lot of them. I love them. And one of their leading public relations people is very close to me. We spent an hour just a week ago, maybe 2 weeks ago. But they are doing everything in their power to make sure that that kind of prejudice does not surface. But I have to say, it's a real potential. And I've seen it from time to time, but not on an organized basis. I hope they don't do that. If they do, I'm going to come out of the blocks like you've never seen anybody come out of the blocks. It's just not right. It's not fair. By the way, I'm the author of the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which is one of the most important pieces of legislation ever in the history of this country to protect religious freedom under the First Amendment and beyond. I'm also the author of the Religious Liberty Protection Act, which is a very, very important bill as well. Now, let me just say this. If I have time to tell an interesting story with Kennedy.
You know, you really don't. Okay. You know what? Those of you who are here are going to be blessed
sport,
to hear Orrin Hatch's story once we get off the air. Forgive me, those of you who are listening right now. Senator Hatch, thank you very much.
You're a good sport.
For being
I'm just
with us. Radio West is a production of KUER News. Our thanks to the Hinckley Institute. Thanks also to Taylor Almond, Michael Havey, Mike Anderson. The show mixed by our engineer, Lewis Downey, produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.